And that would do it. Sixers fans are shocked. They lose Game 7 at home to the Atlanta Hawks. Hawks were 41-31 during the regular season. Philly 49-23. But it is over. Kevin Huerter and the Atlanta Hawks are moving on to the conference finals.
It was one of the best weekends in NBA playoff history. And also, for Sixers believers like me, just the absolute god-awful, insert modifying adjective here, worst. But after two insane Game 7s, the conference finals are all set, with the Hawks and Bucks joining the Suns and Clippers in a postseason whose heart rate could not be more elevated right now. So, Brian Windhorst stops by to help me take a breath and try and process it all. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, June 21st. This is ESPN Daily. What are the rules on profanity in this podcast? Brian, I don't know how else to start.
I'm a spectator at this point. I'm just going to enjoy this.
Brian Windhorst covers the NBA for ESPN, and he's been covering this infuriating game for two decades. Can we bleep that one? Can we just kind of get that one just out of the way? A nice big... I just got up off of the floor, and I don't know if I've ever recorded anything more vulnerably. So thank you for joining me.
You know, and this will not assuage you at all, Pablo, but it's a very strange set of circumstances that have just taken over this whole playoffs. And we had two game sevens where the home team lost. I'll let our statisticians dig through that.
Yeah.
This doesn't happen. But this is a game that this is what I refer to, and I hate to talk to you about this right now, but because this is the type of game that when the demons come, this is the night you remember. it's a line of demarcation game. You know, whatever comes after, whether it's an uplifting story of recovery and rebirth after this, or whether it's the other direction where it's a downturn. This is a continental divide for a franchise. And sometimes they come fast. Sometimes you don't feel them coming. I've been around teams that have had demon games and been in the locker room after demon games. It's not something that I assign to, easily. But that's what it was. And also at the same time, one of the best wins in Atlanta Hawk history, I have to say. And I think that can't be forgotten. It'll be difficult for you to say that the way you feel, but it's also an incredible moment for the Atlanta Hawks.
Yeah, let's just stick with the demon for a second and the map you've drawn, because you're right. You're absolutely right about that. This is a line beyond which there probably is no return. And one of the people I hope does not return, I'm going to give a big spoiler alert here, but I hope this is setting up for a Doc Rivers exit. I'm going to leave that hanging in the air, but I want to dive in, Brian, more specifically into how it is that I am staring at the ghost of Kevin Huerter right now. How, Brian, 103-96, Game 7 in Philly. I would argue the Philadelphia 76ers are multiples more talented than the Atlanta Hawks. And yet at the same time, part of me is just numb to the fact that, of course, there is a demon. And of course, this is how this all goes.
It's even worse than that. Because in this game, Trae Young, the Hawks star, he was 5 of 23 shooting and 2 of 11. The game is in Philadelphia. I mean, home teams in game sevens have a 85% win total. It depends on how far you want to go back. And for the star player to shoot like that, and then they're, you know, I don't know if you could argue who their second best player is, but certainly one of their two or three best players is Bogdan Bogdanovic, and he suffered a knee injury that really limited him. You know, he was not much of a factor in this game and couldn't play at all in the fourth quarter. He's over there with a wrap on his knee. And so for the Sixers to have those cards in their favor and still not be able to pull out the victory, and Kevin Huerter, it's very unusual for a role player to execute in a game seven on the road. It's just very unheard of. And
yes,
I have to say Kevin Huerter has arguably a top five nickname.
Oh, you know what? I am never going to be able to eat red velvet cake ever again. That is one of the many things that the Atlanta Hawks have stolen from me tonight, Brian.
I mean, red velvet is just spectacular. And, you know, he was in the same draft class as Trae Young. So he's always sort of been second fiddle there. And he's had, you know, runs where he's going up and down. He's been mentioned in trade rumors, but to come in and score 27 points in that environment, that's a career maker. Really, seriously, it is. I mean, he wouldn't want his career to be defined by one game in his third season, but it is. And but none of this goes to what I will always remember from this game, and I dare say what you will always remember from this game. And if you passed out and blacked out and don't want to talk
no,
about
go ahead,
it, understand.
Brian. I actually am curious as to which nightmare you're referring to, because there are several that popped to mind when you said that.
3 minutes to go in this game, a 2-point game. Ben Simmons finds himself standing alone under the basket. I mean, 1 foot under, back from the rim. He is 6'10". He is minimal effortly dunking that basketball, with the closest defender being Trae Young, who he's got a foot on. Not a foot, but, you know, a lot of inches. And he throws a pass through traffic to Matisse Thybulle, who gets fouled. And Matisse is not a good free throw shooter, not a good offensive player.
No, makes one of two.
I wouldn't have thrown the ball to anybody. I wouldn't have thrown the ball to Shaquille O'Neal in his prime there.
Yeah. I mean, Brian, look, the Ben Simmons thing, I am the number one Ben Simmons apologist that exists at ESPN.
It's a rough position.
You're telling me it's a rough position. On that play, there is no apologizing. On that play, it speaks to the very thing that even the most diehard Ben Simmons apologist wants him to do, which is not shoot threes, which is not shoot mid-range jumpers. It's to just be as aggressive as you can f-ing be, because, in fact, you're a guy who is designed to attack the rim. But on that particular play, with the season on the line, there is clearly something psychological that has to be addressed with Ben. That needs to be a dunk, and that wouldn't have won them the game. But if he's not going to do that, then the hill I thought I was dying on is not, in fact, the hill I thought.
So Doc Rivers has gone through stages of loss with Ben Simmons in this postseason. You know, Doc has been an ardent supporter of Ben throughout the year.
Publicly,
yes.
To
a point where it's been a strategy, I think, because they know Ben is a little bit fragile mentally, as that moment showed. It's not even about the 2 points. It's about what it says about him. That's the problem that you have. And that's my reaction. My reaction is what it says about him. And he doesn't have to average 20 points a game. Everybody knows that. But
No. And Brian, on that note, like, here's the line that he produced tonight, right? 5 points, 2 of 4 from the field, 1 of 2 from the free throw line, 13 assists, 8 boards, 1 non-field goal attempt that encapsulates him and makes it, I think, so much easier than it has to be to keep the insults coming that obscure all the talents that he has. And that's the vortex that I find myself in, which gets us to how it is that Ben Simmons keeps on finding himself cast in situations where I don't feel like he's being helped either, Brian, by Doc Rivers, who, you know, can we get into that now? Can I just steamroll into this conversation?
That's the stages of loss I'm talking about. So, you know, when Ben was, you know, in the last round getting hacked, the hack of Ben strategy, When he got asked about taking him out of the game, if that would be detrimental to just take him out of the game, Doc really like pushed back. Like, I'm not taking Ben Simmons out of the game. He you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, if you think I need to take Ben Simmons out of the game because he can't make free throws, then you don't know basketball. And, you know, here we are in the second round, and he started taking Ben out of the game because it was a liability. And then tonight after the game, he got asked, and, you know, it's a rough time to give an interview after you have a loss like that. And so, yeah, I'm not gonna like hold him to every syllable on this because it's very emotional. But he got asked if Ben Simmons can be a title winning point guard.
Doc, do you think Ben Simmons can still be a point guard for a championship team like the one you guys want to become?
Yeah, David, I don't know that question or the answer to that right now. You know, so I don't know the answer to that.
That's a fair answer.
A fair answer, and also, like, this offseason is going to be a soap opera of all soap operas for the 76ers. And part of it, Brian, like, has to do with whether Doc Rivers is a title-winning coach in Philadelphia. Like, that to me is the other question, because, look, never changing how he approaches his lineups. Doc Rivers using Dwight Howard with Tobias Harris over and over again in that 18-point choke job, in that 26-point choke job, those consecutive nights, game 4, game 5, and then again seeing it in game 7, I don't think Doc is the answer when it comes to how to unlock the players that the 76ers have.
Okay, so a few things. First off, it's been a bad week for Doc Rivers, not only because of this very unfortunate defeat. The Sixers losing 3 games at home in this series is just, that's a real tough one. And so, I mean, he's got 2-3-1 losses on his resume, and this series, he will not be acquitted well. I mean, one of the things that I'm sure Philly fans are frustrated about, you know, they had a lot of difficulty scoring, only 94 points in game 7. But, you know, a lot of the stuff that they used earlier in the postseason, specifically the Seth Curry, Tobias Harris pick and roll, not to get too X and O here, they just abandoned it. And so it had a bit of a freeze up over there. And also, while you're looking at Philly, you know, I think you have to, you know, think about their general manager, Daryl Morey. I guess he's their president, Daryl Morey. You know, he obviously tried to trade Ben Simmons for James Harden, which was understandable. The Rockets didn't like that deal, and their feeling on Ben Simmons, I think, is relevant to point out. The Rockets had a bit of a rough year in terms of transactions, but that transaction, staying away from that, it's an interesting look right now. The thing I think is more interesting and more important to think about right now is the trade deadline negotiations that they had about Kyle Lowry. If Kyle Lowry was healthy and in this series for the Sixers, my feel is it probably would have been over in the Sixers' favor a few days ago. And they would be in great position now to go into, to have home court advantage against Milwaukee and have a chance at the title, quite frankly. And look, you need 2 teams to trade. The Sixers talks with the Raptors. You know, the Raptors didn't trade Kyle Lowry anywhere else. It was the way they decided to keep him was odd. Maybe they couldn't have made an offer that would have kept him. But the Sixers did not go to the wall to try to acquire Kyle Lowry. And the decision to, you know, to protect a young assets, a guy like Tyrese Maxey or a guy like Matisse Thybulle, the decision to protect those guys and not trade them and instead, you know, try to win with this group, it's fair to second guess it right now. And I think all of that plays into it, other than Ben Simmons just being petrified to get fouled. I think all of that contributes to a situation like this.
Never negotiate on the night of losing a game 7, Brian, because I'm ready to fire. So I'm ready to fire myself, honestly, at this point. I'm so mad at how it is that I became emotionally invested in this team, despite the fact that I believe in so much of the potential of these players, these keystone players. But listen, for the Hawks, Trae Young having a night like this and yet them winning says what to you? beyond the fact that Kevin Huerter has somehow become a 30-point a game guy, and Danilo Gallinari is actually someone who can be trusted in big moments. What does this say to you about Atlanta?
Yeah, I think it's just an example of how seasons are so long and so redemptive if you stick with it, because they were at a point this year where they fired their head coach. You know, they were, you know, it's never a good situation as an organization when you fire your head coach mid-season. And so, you know, there was some belief that, you know, even, you know, their general manager, Travis Schlenk, who now looks like he's solid platinum for putting this team together, that he could be in some sort of jeopardy if they didn't make the playoffs this year. And yet here they are. You know, they played really well after promoting Nate McMillan. You know, he and their team, I mean, they are a team of fighters. They are a team that thrive in adversity. They have won 5 road playoff games in this postseason already in 2 series. And to win in Philadelphia 3 times in a series, you know, they won a couple of times in New York the last round, which obviously the Knicks, you know, going into Madison Square Garden in a raucous environment and in winning with a lot of these guys' first playoff games, it's very unusual. To see a team as the technical underdog overachieve on their first run together, it's a huge, huge outlier. A huge outlier. And to be honest with you, they had no business winning this game. For most of these players, it's their first game 7. You know, now they're in a situation where they are going to be underdogs again. But if you think the Milwaukee Bucks are going to have a rollover, I would not count on that.
Yeah. All right, we'll get into Hawks-Bucks in a second here, Brian. But before I put something like the candle out on these 76ers, is there anything that you want to tell me that I have not expressed either verbally or in sheer tone of voice that I should know about this team?
I think the Sixers have to evaluate about whether they want to go all in. They thought, as the number one overall seed with Joel Embiid having an MVP level year and their pieces, they thought they were good enough to do it. They were not. And so the question that they're going to have to ask themselves, whether it involves Ben Simmons, whether it involves Tobias Harris, whether it involves some other move, is whether they are prepared to go all in to try to do it, you know, with this core group. And that is going to be a vital question as they approach this offseason.
All right, Brian, because I've committed to being all in on finishing this actual podcast, I will save the rest of my takes for a future podcast, and we will get after the break to another series that was absolutely insane to witness, and now the clear Eastern and Western Conference Finals pictures.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1-ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Brian, it's not often that I could say that I attended a game where Kevin Durant hit a game-tying shot.
Here is Durant moving on Tucker. He turns, he shoots. Yes! With 1 second remaining. 1 second left.
And somehow be emotionally underwhelmed in comparison to other things that have happened. but I want to give what you saw in that Nets-Bucks series its fair due, because that was one of the most thrilling Game 7s that has ever been in the NBA playoffs.
You talk about, you know, leaving it all on the court. The players were so exhausted from playing absolutely everything that they, you know, giving everything they absolutely could give. And as a spectator, as somebody who enjoys, you know, the slow tightening that happens in a playoff series, the tension that happens in a game, you know, I love that nuance. It was really so enjoyable to watch. And, you know, the narrowest of margins.
The difference between a size 18 and a size 17 and a half shoe. Yes.
I was at my big ass foot with a step on the line. I was just seeing a little screenshot how close I was to ending a season.
Right. And the crazy thing is, and I can't say for sure that Durant was doing this in Game 7, but Durant likes to wear shoes that are one size too big. Because he likes the feeling of having his foot having sliding around. He likes, he has given an interview to this effect. It was, you know, probably, you know, it was a second round series, so it's kind of hard to compare like some of the finals that Jerry West played against the Celtics with the Lakers, where just the Lakers had the inferior team, but West was the best player. So I don't want to stop short of saying it was the greatest performance by a player in a losing series, but I certainly can say it was one of the greatest. And that gives Durant no solace, because he has an entire trophy case filled, MVP trophies, finals MVP trophies, rings. What he wants to do is winning a championship with the team that, you know, he was part of starting. And that's what this whole Brooklyn thing is. And he fell short of it.
I got to attend Game 5 of this series, Brian, and Game 7. I was at Barclays. I was scouting. I was scouting on behalf of the Sixers. And what I found was a Kevin Durant who played 48 minutes in Game 5, 53 minutes in Game 7, is unimpeachable in the basketball sense. But clearly, at the end of Game 7, could have benefited from help. The idea that Kevin Durant got tired, the idea that James Harden also played 53 minutes despite the hamstring tightness, the idea that Bruce Brown played 52, the minutes accumulated here in this series as a matter of coaching strategy from Steve Nash. What did you make of that?
I thought Steve Nash had good game plans. I think he had his team ready to go, and if he had his team together, he would have won. James Harden revealed in the interview after the series that he had been actually diagnosed with a grade 2 hamstring strain, which is a 4 to 6 week injury. And so, you know, he just tried to play through it, and it came back and bit him. And so, again, I look at it as a miracle that it got to overtime of Game 7. Now the Bucks have all three of their stars healthy. They're tired, but they're healthy. None of them are in protocols. They will have home court in the conference finals as the number 3 seed, which is not something you see every year. And it is all out in front of them. And so while they got through narrowly, they got through, and they get the spoils of having done so.
So with the Milwaukee Bucks now hosting the Atlanta Hawks, what do you expect to see as Giannis Antetokounmpo, who, by the way, no slouch, played 50 minutes and dropped 40 and 13 and 5 in Game 7 to win? What do you expect to see unfold here?
Well, the Nets were a team that was incredibly soft in the interior. I thought they did play above their level defensively overall in the series, and that just to be commended, the Nets defensively. But they're very soft on the interior, and Giannis had the ability, when he was disciplined enough, to get whatever he wanted going to the basket, and that was essentially the strategy that the Bucks went with and won with at the end of the day. You know, Giannis putting up some really great games. He didn't match Durant in this series, but he was pretty good. He had 40 points in Game 7, and he had 30 something in the second half, I think, or to high 20s in the second half, and, you know, basically carried them home. That will not be there, I don't think, against the Hawks, because Clint Capella is a really strong rim protector. And so the challenge will be very different. And, you know, Drew Holiday, who they spent so much three first round picks and young players and everything, and they signed him to a $100 million contract extension, etc. They got him to defend a guy like Trae Young. And so on the other end of the court, you will see, you know, Trae Young will never be totally stopped, but you will see, you know, Drew Holiday made a name for himself in the NBA a few years ago by shutting down Damian Lillard in a playoff series in a surprise upset victory for then the New Orleans Pelicans. Playing that level of defense where he would just smother Lillard is the type of defense they're going to need. And it may very well come down to those types of matchups. Can they hold Trae Young in check? And can Giannis still get his paint points with a much different interior defense?
The last thing on Trae Young, Brian, that I just want to say as a matter of tribute to him, I've called him previously, he's like evil Steph Curry. He's like the Wario of Steph Curry's. But I am so impressed by how he plays and the fact that he is relentlessly, relentlessly attacking. You never feel safe when Trae Young has the ball. And that's true even if he is, as he was on a night like tonight, 5 of 23 from the field, 2 of 11 from 3. He finds ways to absolutely disrupt the other team's defense that, again, at age 22, at 5'9"-ish, like it defies conventional wisdom.
And he plays with savvy beyond his years. I can't remember a player who has blown me away, who has elevated his game in the playoffs like Trae has. Most of the time, and we've seen this certainly this weekend, when you get in the playoffs, it has a very reductive quality. Whatever your fears and your weaknesses are, they bubble to the surface. Unfortunately, with Ben Simmons, that was laid bare. If you have a weak link on your roster, it will be found. It just happens. It's very unusual and gloriously rare for you to uplift above your shortcomings. Even the all-time greats that I've had a chance to witness, like a LeBron James, had to go through some things in the playoffs. Trae Young has just stepped up and delivered in such an impressive way. And it's not that he's hot. You know, he's got a bit of a shoulder injury right now that they won't talk about. Midway, I think it was game 5 or game 4 of this series, he seemed to be a little bit off, and he ended up getting 18 assists. That's the kind of veteran savvy that you just don't see from a guy this age, and is why, you know, the Hawks have to love their chances in this series.
All right, Brian. After the break, we'll get to the Western Conference Finals, where Game 1 has already happened and so much drama has already emerged.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So, Brian, the Western Conference Finals are already underway. In that game, game 1 of this series, Suns-Clippers, it was incredible. And I want to divorce my personal pathetic pain here from the reality of what we saw today, because 120-114, the Phoenix Suns win without Chris Paul, who may or may not have been like texting his brother CJ in the crowd, who then may or may not have been like yelling strategy to the players, according to Rachel Nichols. But they beat the Clippers, who are missing Kawhi Leonard. And I know that degree of absence is the big picture headline around all of this. But when you were watching this game, which was wire to wire as good a game as we've seen in the postseason, what were you paying attention to?
Well, so in the last round, the Clippers went to a small lineup and played Rudy Gobert, the three-time defensive player of the year, including this year, completely out of his comfort zone. And in game six, the clinching game, totally victimized him, where he was too slow and impossible to get out to, and completely undid the Jazz defense, which most of the time is one of the best defenses in the league. And, you know, really reminded you that in today's game, versatility is a vital thing to have. The Jazz weren't versatile enough. So here in this series, without Chris Paul, the big red target for the Clippers becomes DeAndre Ayton, another guy playing in his first playoff series or first playoff run, who is elevating his game. He's obviously a huge factor in the Lakers, who play very big, and then the Nuggets, who have the MVP center. But the Clippers weren't able to get to Ayton today. Ayton is a lot more versatile defensively. He can move around a little bit, and it's one of his great attributes, to be honest with you. He had a really big game. What you take away as you watch the game is that Devin Booker is a budding superstar.
Devin Booker with his first career triple-double, and he does it in the Western Conference Finals.
I mean, Brian, we're talking 40 points. We're talking 15 of 29 from the field. But not just that. 13 boards, 11 assists, living up to hype that no one was even bold enough to give him.
If he plays that way regularly in this series, the Suns will win it in a short order. And he has put forth some great games already in this postseason. And you look at him and you see him blossoming again in his first playoffs. But we knew he could do this. You know, he's been an all-star. He's a guy who is probably underrated. But the Suns, despite not having Chris Paul, had six players in double figures. They repeatedly put five or six players in double figures in their first two round series. And this is who they are. They are a very deep team. They're a confident team. They have a great home court right now because the fans are just euphoric. And, they've got a fighting chance because of their depth. But the Chris Paul situation is completely unique in NBA history. I really don't know how it's going to play out.
So what do we know about why he wasn't available? What do we know as we stand here tonight when he will be available?
Well, he has tested positive for the coronavirus, which it's been reported that he had the vaccine. And that's, you know, what they call a breakthrough infection, which is concerning on a lot of fronts and extremely disappointing for Chris, I'm sure. And especially since he's been in such great position and in an opportunity like this has just never happened to him. And so he is under, even though he's vaccinated, he's under the same protocols that took place for players who tested positive during the season. And in that case, you had to have back-to-back negative tests on back-to-back days, or you had to go through a 10-day process. And a lot of times it stretched to 14 days before your symptoms could be relieved and that you could go through some testing where you could be cleared to play. And Pablo, I don't have the exact numbers, but a majority of the players, and I really even can say confidently, it was a heavy majority of players who tested positive for COVID during the regular season had to go the 10 days after symptoms route. Because getting the back-to-back negative tests was a problem. There were people that had it. There were people that were able to do it. But what that means is, you know, you really, I think it's a reality that Chris Paul could be out 10 to 14 days, hoping again that he's healthy. And we don't, you know, they are not telling us how he's testing. They are not telling us whether he's been symptomatic. But you know, so you have the fallout of actually fighting the virus itself. Although if he is indeed vaccinated, hopefully the case is mild. But it's a long, long explanation of saying the guy could miss three or four games.
The other enormous storyline in this series, looking at how the Clippers have been playing, Brian, of course, has to do with Kawhi Leonard having, is it an ACL? Do we know what Kawhi Leonard is dealing with? Is he definitively unavailable for the rest of the postseason here?
He has a sprained ACL, and just like with James Harden, the severity of the injury was kept private by the team, whether he has a grade one or a grade two sprain. He could have a grade three sprain, which would be very serious because it's the ACL. You'd be talking about potential surgery in that regard. We don't know. We know that he had an MRI initially, and there was too much swelling. They weren't 100% sure the severity of the sprain, which sometimes, and I'm not an orthopedist, but sometimes it's actually a good sign because the swelling gets in there, and the advanced swelling means that the injury isn't so bad, and it's the body trying to heal. But of course, you want to know whether he's going to play. Well, you know, even grade one knee sprains are typically weeks in recovery. Sometimes they're 2 weeks, sometimes they're one. A grade two sprain potentially could be a month or more, or depending on the severity, even three months. So because we don't know the severity, it's very hard to project. But the concept that he is day to day, that he could all of a sudden maybe play in game two or play in game three, I don't think is accurate from my understanding.
So with Kawhi out for some serious amount of time, we turn to a figure who has become kind of inspirational to me, honestly, because Paul George is someone who has been humiliated by the internet for a very long time. He nicknamed himself Playoff P. He is somebody who was seen as a guy not fit for a stage like this. But watching this game today, watching the two games that he played to close out the Jazz in the previous series without Kawhi Leonard, it seems pretty clear that Playoff P is up to this particular moment. What have you seen out of him?
It's remarkable what happens sometimes when perception can switch. So when the Clippers were heavily favored last year, you know, especially in the series of the gift that they lost to the Denver Nuggets, when Paul George came up short, it was really sort of viewed as an indictment on his skills and his character, etc. But this year, because of what's happened to the Clippers, where they have been the victims of injury and have sort of transferred to being, I guess, underdogs, when Paul delivers what he delivers, it's sort of viewed through a completely different lens. And that has been very therapeutic for him. You know, the thing I think about him is his style of play, it leads to inconsistencies. You know, he takes a lot of contested jumpers. He sometimes plays a little bit out of control. He doesn't have the greatest technique. So sometimes if he's just a little bit off calibration, he can have a really bad shooting night. You know, he's like a race car in that regard. When he's fine-tuned, he can be spectacular. Mm. And so he is the type of player who is always going to, in my view, have a wide variance in his game, kind of like a guy who hits the ball 350 off the tee in golf. Days where you're off a little bit, you're going to shoot a ridiculous number, and days where you're on, people aren't going to be able to take your eyes off you. And that's where Paul George is, and he is right now calibrated, but he's come a long way this postseason to prove that he has the ability to do that.
Yeah, and Paul George, like, him versus the internet is such a battle that I want him to win, as he dropped 34 tonight and dropped, you know, 28 before that, 37 before that. And all of which reminds me now that there has probably been a lot of internet taking place since we've started talking. So what have I missed about the Philadelphia 76ers?
Well, there's a Joel Embiid quote that you may want to hear.
Oh my God. I don't, but I do.
I'll be honest. I thought the turning point was when we, I don't know how to say it, but I thought the turning point was just when we had an open shot and we made one free throw and we missed the other and then they came down and scored. We didn't get a good possession on the other end and Trey came back down and made a three and then from there down four. It's on me. I turned the ball over to make something happen, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I thought that was the turning point. That's what he said. He's referring to...
Yes.
Ben Simmons not taking a what if.
We know what he's referring to, Brian. But this is how this is going to go. I mean, it felt like during the regular season, there were months and weeks in which it was hunky-dory, in which the chemistry looked good and sounded good. And here is Joel doing the thing that the rest of us are also doing, which is dissecting his own team and finding out that that play is going to be haunting everybody for a really long time.
I think it's so easy to fall into hyperbole in an emotional moment like this, but I think Ben Simmons passing up that dunk is going to be something that is going to be indelible for a period of going forward that I can't foresee the end of.
I'm going to have to f-ing look at all these quotes. Oh my God, this is going to be a miserable night.
John Collins wore a shirt of him dunking on Joel Embiid in game 6.
It's a total Joel Embiid move. Brian Windhorst, before I unplug my computer and close it and possibly never open it again, thank you for joining me on A Night Full of Demons.
I just realized that I've got red velvet cupcakes in the kitchen.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I will try very hard to talk to you tomorrow.